Among the federal workers not shut out of their jobs today, the good people at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It is Jobs Day Friday, folks, of honestly kind of a weird economic week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, gang, the 4th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. 312,000 is the number of the day on this Friday, the number of new jobs added to this economy last month. It was, as you've heard, I'm sure, way more than anybody was guessing, but also it lands in an economy that does seem to be at kind of an interesting moment. So that moment in the context of the 5 days gone by is where we start today. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. John Harwood is with CNBC. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Lynette, let me start with you. The jobs report today, unadulterated good news?
Unadulterated great news. Yeah. 312 is more than anyone thought. It's just kind of a weird, noisy number since the manufacturing index, the ISM, earlier this week came in looking pretty sad. So we're continuing to get these mixed messages from data. And also we have to remember, you know, holiday season, people get a lot of jobs. December is a job-heavy month, tends to be pretty positive. So, you know.
There is that seasonality. John, I want to turn to you and the Federal Reserve for a minute, and I'm going to play a piece of tape here from Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, doing an event down in Atlanta at the American Economic Association. He was on stage with Janet Yellen and Ben Bernanke and Neil Orr in the New York Times asking him some questions. And Neil said, basically, so look, did maybe you get it wrong in your last press conference back in December when you said, we're going to, you know, maybe think about keep on raising rates? And the markets didn't like that very much. And here's what Powell said.
Markets are expressing concerns, again, about global growth in particular. I think that's becoming the main focus and trade negotiations, which are related to that. And I'll just say that we're listening carefully to that. We're listening with, you know, sensitively to the message that markets are sending, and we're going to be taking those downside risks into account as we make policy going forward.
Sounds a whole lot, John Harwood, like Powell saying to the markets, look, we got your back, man. It's all right.
Yes, he is, but there's interesting cross currents here because the strength of the jobs report suggests the underlying economy is doing pretty well, as Jay Powell has indicated before. And so what is that going to do independently of concern about market sensibilities? Does that encourage the Fed in the next couple of months to say, yes, this economy is strong enough to take a little more normalization of interest rates?
Lynette, let me turn to something that the chairman talked about right at the top of that clip, the global economy. A lot of news this week out of China, and the Fed's keeping an eye on that. And that is contributing to some of the unrest that we've had in the market, some of the volatility.
Absolutely. You know, in fact, Chinese policymakers just took a step to ease financial conditions in their country today.
Right.
They know that it's not just the trade war. The underlying conditions of the Chinese economy look weak, and that's going to have reverberations, especially all over Asia and Australia. So the global economy is looking weak. Emerging markets are looking weak. The United States has been known to kind of, you know, avoid some global burps and bumps.
Yeah.
But with China the size that it is right now, we've never seen a protracted slowdown from the number two economy in the world as it is, as integral and powerful as it is right now.
All right. So, John, let me get to that interesting moment that I sort of talked about setting up the introduction to this interview. We are at a moment in this economy now where the stock market is volatile. We are in the middle of a trade war. The government, oh, by the way, is shut down. And we have a president who says things that are not grounded in economic reality. He talks about the Chinese paying billions of dollars because of the tariffs that he's put into effect, which is simply not true. He talks about the new NAFTA resulting in billions of dollars flowing into this economy, which and thus will help him pay for the wall, which is also not grounded in reality. What are those of us in the fact-based business of explaining the news to do when he does that?
Well, it's challenging because so many of the things that come out of the president's mouth are not true, and you've got to pick and choose what your targets are going to be. But we're seeing the way markets are processing now that his legal and political peril is increasing. Democratic control of the Congress, Mueller investigation proceeding. Yeah. there's more and more concern about the stability of his policy. Is he, in fact, going to try to vindicate his campaign promises about getting tough with China, even if it continues to destabilize markets? My bet is he will not. There's a new delegation going over for trade talks in Beijing next week. What is that going to produce? I suspect it will produce a little bit of an ease-off designed to reassure markets, but we don't know.
That's actually really interesting. Yeah, Lynette, go ahead. And then there's something else I want to ask.
Isn't there a lower-level delegation heading over there?
Right, that's what it is.
It's number twos.
Right, it's not Mnuchin. It's not the trade representative Lighthizer, right? It is number twos and threes.
Exactly. So we're going to set up – we're going to see maybe set up – setting up for talks. We're going to see the Americans feeling out the strength of the Chinese right now because, you know – again, their economy is not doing well.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but before we ran out of time, I had totally forgotten that I wanted to ask you guys about Kevin Hassett, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors at the White House, who came out yesterday and said, yeah, Apple declared an earnings warning this week, and there are going to be more companies that do that. He also said, though, Lynette, look, this is going to force the Chinese to the table because they're in a weaker position than we are. Do you buy that line coming out of the president's chief economic advisor?
Do I buy that they're in a weaker economic position?
And that's going to force them to the table.
Do I buy that it'll force them to the table? No. I mean, the things that they are prioritizing, the things that they want from that the United States wants from China, for them to slow their plans, for them to change the way that they deal with joint ventures and American technology, it just doesn't seem like they are going to give Americans the answers that the Americans want. Yeah. And it doesn't seem like they're going to give the Americans the kind of ability to see into the economy that the Americans are going to want to verify that the Chinese are actually keeping their word.
John Harwood.
Chinese may be in a weaker economic position, but they're in a stronger political position given President Trump's unpopularity.
That's absolutely true. Yeah.
For sure. John, real quick, just because you're in Washington, talk to me about the shutdown, which the president said today, and honestly, you've got 30 seconds to do this. The president said, could go a year. Who knows?
It will not go a year. My guess is that it won't go much more than a week. Next week would be the next scheduled pay period for federal workers. Yeah. And I do think we're beginning to see Republicans get uneasy with the idea of hanging in with President Trump, keeping the government closed while they fight over this wall that most of them know is never going to be built along the 2,000 miles of that border.
John Harwood at CNBC, Lynette Lopez at Business Insider. Thanks, you two.
You bet.
All right.
See
have
you
a nice
later,
weekend. Markets we talked about a little bit. Traders, though, loved them. Some of that Jay Powell this morning. The jobs report did not hurt either. Details, numbers, you know the drill. So the headline on this morning's jobs report, as Lynette and John and I were talking about, was good. But there are some, I guess you'd say, finer points that'll help to really understand what's going on, both in today's data and in the longer term. Because when it comes to the economy, there is a difference between knowing how it has been doing and how it is gonna do. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
When you see a jobs report for December, Francis Donald at Manulife Asset Management says you actually learn more about how companies were doing 3 to 6 months ago.
Because it takes time for companies to respond to good news, to then translate that into hiring, to find the right people and get them in the right place.
That's why jobs reports are often considered lagging indicators, numbers that say more about the recent past than the future. Housing data is another one. Those reports tend to reflect what happened over the last month. Donald says some lagging indicators are just not that helpful, like GDP.
In large part, it's because we already know all the pieces of the entire U.S. economic story by the time GDP even lands.
That's because economists also use another type of data to predict the future, leading indicators, like permits for a new building, surveys of how CEOs and manufacturers are feeling. And if you know where to look, the jobs report has a few of those hints, too. The University of Oregon's Tim Dewey watches for the number of new temporary workers.
Generally, when firms start to see weaker economic conditions, the first people they lay off or stop hiring are the temporary help workers.
But temporary workers have been rising. Dewey says that's a sign employers plan to keep hiring people. Guy LaBaugh, a fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott, says jobs reports don't tend to turn on a dime. In fact, he says good jobs reports create momentum for more good reports.
So between jobs momentum and forward-looking surveys, the economic outlook is far from negative.
But far from negative isn't the same thing as really positive. LaBaugh says stock and bond markets have been signaling their belief that economic growth is flattening. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
There was a certain element of what looked like not great news in today's jobs report turning out to actually be pretty good news after all. I'm talking about the part that saw the unemployment rate go up from 3.7% to 3.9% last month. How can that be, I hear you asking, when we added 300-something thousand new jobs last month, Kai? Well, I'm going to tell you. Marketplace's Andy Euler is going to introduce us to something called the labor force participation rate.
The labor force participation rate is a measure of the country's working age population that engages actively in the labor market, or in normal people terms, people who are working plus those who want to work but remain unemployed.
And unemployed specifically means to search for a job in the last 4 weeks and they're available for a job as one is offered to them.
That's Princeton economist Alan Krueger. So is it fair to say that the uptick in the unemployment rate last month is because of the rising labor force participation rate?
That is fair.
Thanks, Alan. Floor is yours.
We saw the participation rate tick up by 0.2 percentage point and the unemployment rate rise by 0.2 percentage point. So the reason why the unemployment rate rose last month as more people came into the labor force.
The participation rate in December ticked up a bit, but for the last few years, it's been pretty flat. Gary Bertlis at the Brookings Institution says that has a lot to do with demographics.
Age composition of the population is getting older, so we have more people past 65, past ages where we expect them to be participating.
So even a small increase in the participation rate, well,
that is good news because we have been worried about the decline in labor force participation, especially among prime-age adults.
A higher participation rate is a sign of a strong job market and continued recovery from the Great Recession. In recessions, some people get too discouraged to even look for a job. Today, though, more people are feeling good about their job prospects. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
So there's the U.S. labor force, 162, 163 million people, plus or minus, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics as of last month. And then there's the labor force participation rate, as Andy was telling us, 63.1% last month, also from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But look, who are these people, especially the ones who've decided in the past month or so that now was the time they wanted to get back to work? Marketplace's Renata Sago talked to some people who are looking or who just started working after some time away to find out what's going on.
Lynn Stewart left her longtime job as an administrative assistant at a nonprofit back in 2016. She was 70 years old at the time and thought after devoting her whole career to social service, she wouldn't have to work again. That's until rent started rising and her Social Security couldn't cover it.
I felt I was in danger of becoming homeless if I did not have additional income, so I started looking for part-time work. It's not like I had a whole lot of savings.
So at 72, she's working again, this time helping other seniors find jobs in Orlando's labor market. Jimmy Mertoon is an employment specialist for Goodwill. He sees lots of seniors and people with disabilities submitting their resumes because the benefits they receive aren't enough.
The bills are higher for them because of living.
Then there are people seeking full-time work as a path to financial stability. Shanita Burton is 30 years old. She started looking for a job in December after 10 years of doing hair on and off and dealing with inconsistent income. But she's waiting to find the right fit, position, and salary.
I want to find a job that I love, something that I can go to, that I love them, they love me.
Meanwhile, Mirto Rosario will take any job she can find. The 61-year-old lost hers in November. She's getting about $800 in unemployment a month, but it's not enough to cover her expenses. But even with a strong job market, she's cautious about putting some things on her resume, like a salary history that might take her out of the running for a lower paid position.
I don't want to put any salary because I know if I put something, they're going to just go back off.
Even with the low unemployment rate, she says it can be tough for older workers like her to find a job. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Coming up. Movie credits. So very many movie credits. But first, sure, let's do the numbers. It's a noun, five syllables, the tendency to change quickly and unpredictably. Yes, volatility is with us still and again. Dow Industrials up 746 points today. That is after yesterday's plunge, 3.2%, closed at 23,433. The NASDAQ surged 275 points, 4.25%, 67.38. The S&P 500 up 84, 3.4%, 25.31. For the Seesaw Week, stocks ended up, the Dow up 1.6%, the NASDAQ added 2.3%, S&P 500 found itself 1.8% higher today. Chipmaker Intel jumped 6.1%, Bank of America Merrill Lynch upgraded Intel stock to buy, competitor Advanced Micro Devices rose 11.4%. Apple, you might have heard, lost almost 10% yesterday after that profit warning. Today, gained back some of that, rose 4.2%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So look, here is the thing about kids. One of the things. Anyway, they got to get places. And then they got to get home from those places. And things are just different in this economy than they used to be. It's different for parents working. It's different around the whole idea of latchkey kids. It's also different, by the way, in the age of Uber. Rebecca Highwall wrote for Wired about the industry being built around getting kids around. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I'm well. So look, let me ask you, first of all, and this might seem a really boneheaded question, but why can't Uber just be Uber for kids? Why do you need a special company or a special app to be Uber for kids, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Well, right now, Uber, according to its terms and services agreement, does not want unaccompanied minors on its service. It says the minimum age to ride is 18. So technically, you're not allowed, and Uber drivers aren't equipped to or prepared to be taking care of children. So these companies have sort of stepped in to do that.
What is then the differentiator for these companies? Because there are a bunch of them out there. Most of them are based here in California, as it happens. But what are the services they offer?
So unlike Uber or Lyft, you typically would order the night before. What they offer essentially are drivers who are extremely background checked or interviewed, have their cars inspected, their driving records are looked at, and most of them have a significant amount of childcare experience.
Sure. Just on that scheduling thing. So the deal is that I can't, say, Hop, Skip, Drive, which is one of these companies, on my 14-year-old's phone, and then when he gets out of soccer practice, he can just dial one up, right? That's not the way it works?
Not typically. The idea is that your child would know when soccer practice ends each Thursday or Tuesday.
Right.
And you also, the parents would want time to make sure that they're comfortable with the driver. You would get sent the driver info the day before, so you'd have that information to make sure you're comfortable. So it's not as on-demand as sort of Uber or Lyft is, but it's sort of has the ease of being able to track the ride, and you have the optimization sort of benefit of only needing it when you need it. You don't need to hire a babysitter for the entire afternoon just because you have two kids that need to get from point A to point B.
All right, look, so let's cut to the chase here. How much is all this going to cost me, right? Because I cannot imagine that pre-scheduling all these things and having a safety check driver and an inspected car, it's not going to be cheap.
Right. Yeah, it's certainly a bit more expensive than something like an Uber or a Lyft ride. So Zoom, for instance, one of the services says that their rides start around $16, and then it's $6 for every 15-minute increment. But you can also sort of buy in bulk in the sense that if you always know your kid's going to need a soccer practice pickup, so you can sort of buy that in advance for the month.
Is there one of these that is going to win out in this competition? Because as you lay out in this article, there have been, at least a couple, several even, that have failed, right?
I think that what will be interesting to sort of look forward in the future is how they kind of expand relationships with the schools. And I think that might come into play. And then another thing to sort of look out for as well is how whether they try to expand in terms of older Americans as well, who also need help getting around and could really use a service like this as well. So I think which company sort of comes out on top, it'll really depend on that. But these ones, I think Zoom, Kango, and Hopskip Drive are doing pretty well right now.
Rebecca Hawal writing for Wired about kid-oriented rideshare services. Rebecca, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. You too.
If you've been to the movies lately during the holidays or elsewise, chances are you sat through a lot of stuff that was not the movie. You got the pre-movie credits, you got the post-movie credits, which you never know might have an Easter egg hidden somewhere, so you kind of got to stick around. But why, oh why, the creep of the credits? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
If you saw last year's Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, you would have had a familiar experience. Screen goes dark, moody, foreboding soundtrack kicks in, and the movie... Nope, that's just the studio animation for Universal Pictures. And now... Nope, that's another one for Amblin Entertainment, Steven Spielberg's company. And finally... Oh wait, here comes one for Legendary Entertainment. And now Dino Time. Okay, that took a while. Fast forward to the end of the movie... And the credits last a whopping 9 minutes and 30 seconds. That's an addition of more than 3 minutes over the original 1993 Jurassic Park, which might have started with the coming attraction or two,
Mrs. Doubtfire,
the theater reminders to throw away trash and only smoke in the lobby, before one of those animations for Universal Pictures then... Back in the day, the show began. Well, a lot more has changed than smoking laws since then.
There's no question that there are more company credits and more individual credits on movies these days.
Tom Noonan is a producer and lecturer at UCLA's film school. He says it's always been common to see a lot of companies attached to independent films because indie filmmakers typically cobble together funding from a number of sources. But that's increasingly how major studio movies get made, too.
The risk with movies has never been higher. So studios, production companies, distribution companies are sharing risk in ways that they never agreed to before.
That means studios taking on more equity partner companies, which invest in a film for a share of the profits. And that complex financing arrangement is often reflected in longer producing credits, says Jason E. Squire, who teaches the business of film at the University of Southern California.
Sometimes we see a whole lot of executive producers. That means that each of them has made a contribution in some way to get the picture made.
Like wrangling money or getting talent attached. Someone might even get a co-producer credit for simply making introductions that lead to funding. In fact, the number of producing credits for the top-grossing films between 1994 and 2014 doubled, according to the film data researcher Stephen Follows. But these days, it's visual effects making those extra-long credits so long. Not just for giant dinosaurs, but even tiny details like water droplets or realistic fur. Maybe highly specialized work that's compensated with both money and a screen credit.
People have kind of gotten addicted to being able to do whatever they want to do storytelling-wise.
Mark McCora is a visual effects producer for movies like Twilight and Knight of Cups. He says with the increasing number and complexity of visual effects in many films, it's not uncommon for 10 or more visual effect companies to work on a project. That last Jurassic World lists 15, and the latest Star Wars, more than 20.
You'll have like a specialist company that's doing just maybe a couple of the elements for like certain shots.
That adds up to more than 1,000 visual effects credits on many blockbusters. But McCora says the credit roll could last even longer. Many more visual effects producers go uncredited on screen, so you can thank them for getting to that Easter egg scene just a little bit sooner. In Los Angeles, I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Thank you. This final note on the way out today, we started with the American workforce. We are going to end with the American workforce, one very particular slice of it, one actually specific job in it. We go back to the American Economic Association meeting again. Neil Irwin of the New York Times asking the question, Jay Powell answering.
If the president asked you to resign, would you do it? No.
So two things. One, you gotta love how Powell did not miss a beat with that no, right? Also, though, number two, that, of course, is the right answer. I am not sure why people were laughing. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 746 points today, 3.2%. NASDAQ up 275, 4.25%. S&P 500 gained 84 points, 3.4%. Once again, say it with me now, volatility. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the Senior Vice President and General Manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a good weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.